This is Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Scott Greenberg. What happens when healthcare stops waiting for you to get sick? Anmol Madan, PhD, is an MIT-trained computer scientist who spent two decades teaching machines to understand human behavior.
Dr. Madan is the founder and CEO of a company called Radiant Graph. It uses AI to help health systems catch problems before they become emergencies. In his new book called The Machines Will See You Now, A Human Roadmap to Autonomous Healthcare, it lays out a future where AI handles diagnostics and prediction, freeing doctors to focus on things like empathy and human connection. Anmol Madan, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me, Lynn and Scott.
It's great to have you. I think back to the day, and we've all been here, where we go to the doctor and, okay, you know, back in the early days of the internet, we might spend some time looking up and trying to self-diagnose. Oh, and the doctors hated that so much. But honestly, even where we are now with the AI that we have at our own fingertips, we can arrive at the doctor with a pretty decent diagnosis, yes or no?
Or so, I won't vouch for the accuracy of the diagnosis that we're seeing. I think, you know, there's a lot of stuff happening in sort of the consumer tech. But what I will tell you is there's a couple of trends that are pretty clear. I think one, we as consumers are seeking information about our health. And, you know, if it's not ChatGPT, it's Google or it's TikTok. So people are going for this information elsewhere. Right, so that shift has occurred in our society. The other trend is you look at the performance of large language models, you look at how they're benchmarking against, you know, benchmarks that are used to assess the knowledge of the understanding of medical knowledge or decision-making ability. That curve has just been really steep in terms of improvement of performance, right? Especially in the last two or three years with the advent of LLMs in increasingly LLMs that are trained on healthcare-specific data, medical data, like we're seeing these models work really well. I think the gap and sort of my reason for writing the book is I think the dialogue is fundamentally broken because on one side, there's a lot of computer scientists like myself who are excited about what these technologies can do, but don't quite understand like how this has to get rolled out and the implications for healthcare in our society. And then on the other side, you've got a healthcare workforce that is looking at these systems and they're kind of like toddlers learning how to walk. So they do stumble a fair bit, right? In awkward ways and saying like, are we really going to turn these on in a way that we think of automating or scaling healthcare in the future, right? So I think the real answer is somewhere in between. And, yeah, you know, the book, the subtitle of the book is the Human Roadmap to Autonomous Healthcare. And one of the early chapters, I actually lay out what the different stages are, what that roadmap could look like, starting from present day to kind of like a cruise control for doctors, which is kind of the next chapter, to machines taking on some more of the diagnostic or treatment workload for the simplest of cases and the simplest of situations. And then, you know, a couple of decades from now, taking on more and more complexity, right? And so I think if we wear that lens and we think about the future, and what's going to happen in the next couple of decades as these trends emerge, I think it'll take that fear and anxiety we have about these systems and the risks that we have and allow us to translate that into thoughtful regulations, guidelines, measurement and validation methodologies that the entire ecosystem and the entire industry can adopt. So that's kind of where, you know, I'm hoping to bridge the dialogue that's broken today.
There's such hype around AI right now, but we do fear it. We're anxious about it, whether or not we're a consumer of it, or for example, we're in the healthcare profession,
thinking about how it could possibly threaten our livelihood.
But one of the things that we enjoy about, you know, looking up on something like ChatGPT is, boy, they have all day for us. It has all day to ask us more questions about how we're feeling. And with the large language model, they're pertinent questions, right? I just read an interesting statistic. 70% of doctor visits end up in the doctor interrupting you when you're trying to describe your symptoms.
And this is not to say anything about the doctors, but more about the healthcare industry in general, where it is a profit, a for-profit model. doctors don't have the time that they would like to be able to spend with each patient.
Could these predictive models help really free up a medical professional to be more human and to spend more time?
Yeah, and then that's exactly the promise, right? And by the way, before I talk about healthcare, we've seen this in every other industry. And so in one of the chapters, I talk about, you know, I make the comparison to traveling across the Atlantic, right? So 200 years ago, if you were in a ship, you'd have to kind of pull the rudder and pull the sails and you'd be climbing up the mast. And, you know, and today there is a pilot flying a 787 or whatever jetliner you have. 90% of the flight is on autopilot. And we've built the right safeguards and the right mechanisms to trust the machines to do some of those kind of run-of-the-mill flying tasks, except for things like landing the plane and takeoff in emergency situations, right? So I think what it means is the same amount of humans, or a smaller number of humans, are having a much bigger impact, and it's a much better quality of life for them than it was. And by the way, this is true for every industry that's gone through a transformation, right? It's not just healthcare, it's not just transportation, it's true for manufacturing, it's true for every other professional job that's gone through that digitization and transformation. So that's the comparison I try to make. I think to go back to your point of where this impacts things in healthcare, you know, already we are seeing, even today, with the advent of voice AI systems, care management type of tasks, case management, so non-diagnostic, non-treatment tasks, but machines coming in and helping, you know, provide feedback and support for a person who's just got diagnosed with type 2 diabetes and or just got diagnosed with a mental health condition, as learning how to manage. And to your point, you know, once, you know, has questions, maybe has questions at 2 a.m. on a Saturday, right? And they want to be able to, so these systems are already coming in and filling that void. I think there's room for us to create the right safeguards and the right regulatory pieces to make sure they're safe, they're tested, they're validated against kind of in, you know, standard medical protocols. They're efficacious for what they're doing. And I think we're early in that journey, but I think that problem can be solved, especially in a partnership between the medical community and the AI community working together and defining those safeguards, right? So I think that's already happening. I think the next chapter then, the next kind of evolution of that, if you fast forward a few years from today, is do these machines take on the simplest of clinical diagnosis and treatment tasks? Right. And if they're kind of running the mill things, if they're single kind of order decision tree, and that's never happened, by the way, in healthcare, right? We have categories of what's called clinical decision support software. So we have systems that'll say, like, here is a recommended treatment or the recommended medication, recommended path, but we've never had machines come in and take on the full cycle. But I think with this current generation of technology, it seems like we're not actually that far away for the simplest of tasks, right? So these things are, again, I think we do need. This change is not going to happen without the leadership of the medical community. Even professionally for me in my day job, our chief medical officer, our medical directors, my clinical colleagues kind of are really invested in the success of designing these systems. And I think we're going to need their support and participation. But I think if done right, it kind of takes away the things that are easy, obvious, you know, kind of things that they haven't had time for. In terms of their kind of workload as well. And I think the industry is sort of very early today. People are thinking of documentation and note-taking, but I think that's just like super tactical. I think there's going to be parts of care delivery that go through the same shift in the next couple of years.
Well, Dr. Madan, I actually have a number of personal connections to physicians and people in the healthcare world who 20, 25 years ago when WebMD first came out, and these physicians are practicing in a major metropolitan area where, you know, admittedly, maybe the population has 2 or 3 degrees, you know, pretty well educated. They've got access to WebMD, and they would already come into the office with a differential diagnosis that they were then dictating to the physicians. Yeah. And these physicians were of two camps. One was, oh, that's, you know, that's interesting. Let's explore that. And the other camp was, you know what? I'm the doctor here, and let's go through the whole kit and caboodle ourselves. And I'm fascinated by now the huge leaps that this has taken, both in artificial intelligence and just in general knowledge, over the last 5 years. And what is the shift in the perception of the medical profession to accept this brave new world of AI and maybe patients coming in with much more data today than they did under the old WebMD days 20, 25 years ago?
Yeah, and Scott, I'm not a medical doctor, I'm a computer scientist, so I won't speak for the individual medical doctors here, but I will give you the other side of it. I'll tell you what we as AI experts and practitioners working with the medical community and the regulatory community can do to kind of earn that trust, right? So let's wear the hat of like, what would it take for a medical professional, a doctor, a nurse who's been practicing for 20, 25 years to start to trust these technologies? What kind of evidence would they want to see? And I think, while there is a lot of hype about AI and I've been in this field for a couple of decades and I'm excited that, it's at the front and center of our society in the way we all thought it would be, I think we need to balance that with creating the right framework for judging how these systems are tested, validated, and safe. So I'll give you an example of, what you mentioned earlier, person going in and chit-chatting with an AI agent, pick your favorite one, right? I'm not picking any particular company here, that helps you understand, not even a diagnosis, but differential diagnosis, but even helps you understand, hey, how do I manage my chronic condition? How do I manage my stress levels and anxiety levels? I have a stressful job, I travel a lot, right? And so you're kind of chit-chatting, right? And so what are the safeguards that we are defining, right? How are the benchmarks? How do we compare that to the performance of human coaches or human therapists who would engage in the same conversation? What is the point at which, if say 1% of those conversations, and I'm making up kind of a rough ballpark, but if 1% of conversations, the person's really depressed, or they're in the middle of a symptom that, acute symptoms, or maybe God forbid they're having suicidal thoughts. Like, what is the safeguards to escalate that? And do they meet or exceed the bar that we're expecting for human care and human practitioners, right? So again, in that same task. And then, to your point of the, obviously the machines are much more available, right? The unit cost of, an hour or minute of engaging with the machine is obviously much lower, right? So if we do meet the same clinical safeguard bar, right? And I think we as an industry have to define that. I think the way it's defined right now is very immature, if I may use that phrase, right? And I say this as a computer scientist myself. The industry thus far has been benchmarking against things, the way these data sets, MedQA, others, which are essentially data sets to test human knowledge, human medical knowledge, or human medical expertise. These machines fail in slightly different ways, right? They have slightly different kinds of errors. They're good at different things, they fail in different ways. So we have to rethink some of those benchmarks. And by the way, this stuff isn't hard. It's going to get solved in the next couple of years, if not today, right? But I think if we as an industry can align on those and say, like, here's the box, here's a human conversation, here's what we expect in terms of the quality of the clinical knowledge the human has, the empathy, the adaptability and flexibility to adjust their tone and style to the person's needs, the completion of the clinical action or task that we're asking the person to do, right? Whether it's kind of manage their stress or, manage their diabetes or, some kind of gradual lifestyle change. If we meet those criteria and there's publications and evidence that we have to invest in as a community to side prove that out, I think it becomes a lot easier to go to that provider who's done this, a doctor who's done this for 2 decades and say, hey, trust these systems. I think in the absence of that evidence, and I think that evidence is very early today, it's very, very premature, sort of like just emerging, it's hard for the medical community to trust these systems. And I don't think they should either. And so the point of laying out a roadmap is let's define the success, the bar at each of those levels, and then hold the entire industry up to that bar and say, hey, can we actually operate at this level?
I'm glad you brought up the topic of safeguards, because I think maybe you're aware of this lawsuit that's going on right now. I think in California, there's a pastor who engaged, and I want to say it's ChatGPT, OpenAI, where he engaged into a very deep conversation with an artificial intelligent bot about his medical condition. And this went on and on and on, and his condition got worse. And essentially, the chatbot told him to pray. And of course, he ends up in the hospital. And now there's a very significant lawsuit that is surrounding this. So where the pastor, now granted, there's got to be a degree of common sense from the user as well. I mean, that was obvious to me when I was hearing this.
I'll kind of come at this from a slightly different. So yes, there's common sense, but I also think we have to teach people. We have to teach the consumer how to use these systems. Right. So an example in that, and you know, I don't know the specific case here, but just having looked at these systems now in my career, like there's a certain amount of context. If you look at Brill from a mathematical perspective, Scott, like it's a machine, right? And it's kind of generating tokens, it's generating words effectively. There's a certain amount of context it sort of can maintain. And after that, its performance kind of decays, right? So even if we taught people and say, hey, if you're going to engage in a conversation, realize that after 10 minutes, it's probably not going to be very sharp and good, right? Or after 10 minutes, let's take a break and let's have it reset the, like, let's create the right ways of, you know, and I think this is what I mean is we're kind of like throwing these technologies out there. And I think if we just take a minute, and I don't think we have like pause the whole industry or change regulatory bodies, you know, if we just take a minute and say, okay, what are the right mechanisms? What are the use cases we do think are ready today? And for anybody who's going to build a product, how are they going to deal with the issue of 30 minutes into a conversation, the agent has lost context, it's muddling up all the facts, it doesn't know what to answer anymore, right? And by the way, this is what I meant earlier, a human doesn't feel that way, right? If you're talking to a human therapist 45 minutes down the line, you know, a human therapist does not have that decaying conversation quality, right? But if you're expecting an agent to carry context windows over that period, and you know, yes, there's technical improvements, and yes, we can do, you know, RAG and this and that. But like putting that aside for a second, the technical bits, we need to teach people that this is how these systems are going to fail. And by the way, not just consumers of healthcare, but that should probably be part of the curriculum of providers and hospitals and institutions that are going to adopt these technologies. Right, that are going to be like, look, if you're going to be a nurse that's allocating some of your caseload to an AI system, to an AI care manager, an AI coach, remember this is how these resources are going to fail. And by the way, they will fail. Right? I mean, just like I said, they're toddlers walking. It doesn't mean that they're not important to scaling access and quality of care in our society. Right, we have the most expensive healthcare system in the Western world with the worst outcomes. We have a lot of work to do, so we do need these tools. But we need to kind of define the box we want them to play. So I think that's the part where I feel like there's the extremes is like the AI people tweeting, hey, machines can solve 99%. It's kind of not really true. I mean, yes, mathematically, but you're missing all the other stuff. And then the medical community, the act in that, some parts of it are embracing, but some parts are like, hey, this isn't safe. This isn't tested. And so I think we need to kind of meet in the middle and then lay out examples of how we can meet in the middle at different stages in our society.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Anmol Madan. He is the founder and CEO of a company called Radiant Graph, using AI to help health systems catch problems before they become emergencies. And he's written a new book, and I might say it's a new book that's really entertaining and easy to read. It's called The Machines Will See You Now. It's a human roadmap to autonomous healthcare. You know, it's funny, Anmol, when you were just answering Scott's question, it made me think about, you know, you said even these AI agents will go down a rabbit hole, or the conversation gets tired and after about 10 minutes, you should, you know, take a break or whatever. It seems like it's been about 6 months, maybe less. Yeah. We haven't been talking about AI hallucinating. I haven't heard that term for a handful of months now. And we know it's evolving very rapidly.
Yeah.
Are those hallucinations still taking place?
Yeah, I'll try to answer that question. So I'm sure there are mathematical reasons, if you think of how an LLM is structured, why hallucinations occur, right? And so the way the information is captured, the way the probabilities are captured. So there's a mathematical foundation. I think what we have gotten much better, at least from things I'm seeing in practice in industry with real world applications, and healthcare being an important area where this matters significantly, is creating safeguards and creating ways to catch some of those hallucinations when they occur. And so if you think, and I think this is where I think we're always on a curve, right? There's so much about this new class of LLMs and transformers that we don't quite understand. And so one of the concepts I talk about in the book is, I think we're still learning, with previous classes of AI, with machine learning, reinforcement learning, deep learning, right? Graphical models a couple of decades ago, right? We kind of, at some point, you put in so much knowledge into the model, whether it's the layers or of the network or different kind of mathematical formulations, that you kind of broke the model. Like it wasn't able to absorb any more knowledge, right? We haven't hit that limit yet with LLMs. And by the way, we haven't hit that limit with like the whole like, large LLM model. But also, even when that happens, we're probably going to spin off a whole bunch of kind of LLMs and agents that are very specific to certain things. And so they'll be able to encapsulate a lot of knowledge further, right? So like this idea of having a swarm of LLMs or smaller agents working together. So I think we're just kind of scratching, we haven't hit the hard technical limits yet. And so I think a lot of things that are issues, practical issues that we're running into, there's a lot of optimism from in the people building these tools that these practical issues can be overcome. They may not be overcome by stuffing all the knowledge in the model or sort of overcoming the and there are certain mathematical things that people are testing to kind of think about hallucinations and how it can be overcome. They might be overcome in a different way. It might be, an adversarial model that's kind of testing for like continuity in conversation, right? The most recent incarnation of the stuff is sort of the self-learning, the self-improving models, right? So I think there's a lot of excitement in the computer science community about what how far we can push these. And I think the general belief is we're just scratching the surface. There's a lot of practical issues to be solved. There's a lot of like safety and testing and benchmarks and clinical quality and efficacy issues to be solved. And I talk about some of the gaps that I think are some of the problems that are going to be harder to solve than we think in the book as well. But I think it's an exciting time to be alive and to be working on these things.
Yes, it is. Well, Anmol, you're an entrepreneur. You've been in the healthcare space for a long time. You're also a technologist, computer scientist. You're also a very warm person. You're a very human person. So I'm wondering for you, when you are in a quandary about what's going on with you personally, health-wise, when do you crave humanness or human contact to help you out? Because you have all these tools at your disposal. You know how to put in the data correctly to get a more accurate outcome. I feel like humanness is going to be more and more appreciated as we kind of come full circle on all of this. What for you is the humanness that you crave?
And I think that's the part I don't quite, it's sort of hard to make predictions for. And so for me personally, you're right. I think as with all of us, right, we crave human interactions. There's something trustworthy about sitting across the table or sitting across a video session with a healthcare professional that has spent decades. And like you can show me all the research papers and I work in it, but like there's something about it. There's a human connection that matters, right? And more sort of as we enter this era of society, I sort of appreciate that. And sometimes I've been thinking a lot about it. And in the book, I kind of make a lot of examples to, how science fiction has told out this stuff will play out. Right. And there are different scenarios inside. So like there's like the Mad Max universe, and then there's the like the Star Trek where it's a benevolent, society. I'm not sure which one we'll end up on. And I think we probably hopefully end up somewhere in the middle of those two. But like one another I was thinking about this. So I make in as a hobby and less now, but I make furniture as a hobby. So wooden furniture is a hobby, right? And it's one of those where there's something, for most things you probably want to buy something that was manufactured and kind of like does the job. But there's certain points where if you're making a dining table, like there's something charming and romantic about making your own dining table out of a piece of oak that you found or walnut that you found, right? And so I think to me, I wonder if like that's what happens to the human connection. That maybe not just in healthcare, but in every industry, that there's a base level of functionality and comfort and sort of competence that you get from machines. But then for those of us, like there are people who you know, we have cars, but some people still ride horses and they have horses, right? And so it becomes one of those things where like the human connection is kind of like the special thing. And, you know, like part of like the connection that we all seek. So, and again, that may be a 20-year, 30-year horizon. That's not a 2027, you know, thing that's happening in our industry. I think, like I said, the machines are still, they're kind of like toddlers. There's a lot of opportunity. There's a lot of growth potential, but they're still kind of pretty clunky. But if you fast forward 2 decades from now, and you sort of look at, you know, what the science fiction like is, you know, people get the mass market version, that's the healthcare robots. And then if you want a human professional, you know, that's a very kind of special bespoke experience that exists. And I don't know, maybe that's the future we end up in.
Yes, maybe it is. Well, Anmol Madan, it has been such a pleasure speaking with you. The book is The Machines Will See You Now. It's a human roadmap to autonomous healthcare. This is a good one to read. There are a lot of books on AI, but this one's a lot of fun and informative. Thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me on this show. So thank you, Scott.